Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. We are kicking off Financial Literacy Month this week. This is a really, really big deal for us. Think of any big celebration in the world of sport or music or movies. It's our FIFA World Cup, our Coachella, our Toronto International Film Festival. We spend so much of the year planning for FLM, as we call it, and here we are. Our focus this year is on newcomers. Newcomers to Canada are such an important part of Canada's history and Canada's future. Hundreds of thousands of people arrive here every year, and they don't have an easy time navigating the financial system. So we've got a number of things on deck to support newcomers in that regard, and you're going to hear some of them on the radio today. Today, you'll hear from Supriya Sial, Deputy Commissioner at the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. Jason Mullen, CEO of Easy Financial, will be here. He's going to talk about the efforts that they are making for both newcomer clients and newcomer employees. You're also going to hear about our new e-learning platform for newcomers. It is free. It is online education about navigating credit. And get this, it's in 8 languages. We've done this in 8 languages. It's amazing. All of this is possible thanks to our sponsors. So of course, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and Easy Financial, personal, home equity, and auto loans with personalized rates and terms made for you. We're also grateful for the support from Indeed Canada, the number one job site worldwide and the number one source of hires in Canada. Plus, the Canadian Bankers Association. It is the voice of more than 60 domestic and foreign banks that help drive Canada's economic growth and prosperity. We also appreciate the support of Achieve, a leading charitable organization that delivers employment, newcomer, language, youth, women, and inclusion services in the Greater Toronto area. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Happy Financial Literacy Month. Let's get started. Financial Literacy Month needs a song. It's like a theme song or an anthem. Maybe sung by Shawn Mendes. I don't know. And well, that is a key priority for me for Financial Literacy Month. It is, perhaps surprisingly, not the number one priority for the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. The FCAC is the federal agency responsible for protecting the rights and interests of consumers of financial products and services. It is also the lead agency behind financial literacy efforts across Canada. And its priority this year, its focus, its theme is managing debt. Okay, fine. All right, fine. Also important. Managing debt is a critical part of building financial resilience. And this is a phrase that we're going to talk about in this interview. Supriya Sial is Deputy Commissioner at the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. And we spoke earlier about the agency's focus on building financial resilience. And a happy Financial Literacy Month to you.
And a happy Financial Literacy Month to you as well, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
What do you mean when you use the phrase financial resilience?
I think the word resilience is a word we more commonly associate with mental health. You know, we think of it as a form of strength, fortitude, if you will, to surmount rather than succumb to the challenges that life throws our way. And financial resilience is actually, it's not different. It is the ability, the way we define it, as it is the ability to adapt or persevere through both predictable and unpredictable financial choices, difficulties, shocks in life. So just as psychological resilience allows people to recover and get past negative life events, financial resilience allows people to recover and get past negative financial events.
We are meeting on the radio. For those of you listening, not while you're driving, you can't do this while you're driving, but if you're listening at home, do a search for the National Financial Literacy Strategy and the FCAC, because you're going to see this really great graphic. It's very clear. It's very compelling. And at the heart of it is this notion of financial resilience. On top of that, there's what can enable consumers to achieve, and then what you call ecosystem changes, which we'll talk about. What's the main goal of the National Financial Literacy Strategy?
Helping Canadians build financial resilience. You know, we are very cognizant of the fact that, that we're in an uncertain fiscal environment. And I would say that in many ways, financial resilience is the thing that helps you weather those storms, those fiscal storms that come your way. So the main goal of the strategy is building financial resilience. And what it does is it lays out a framework for how we can enable consumers to build that financial resilience by changing the ecosystem that they operate in, as well as by helping them develop the five consumer building blocks that you were just alluding to, Bruce. And the idea is that together, these things as a whole will create the context, or will create the set of behaviors that will lead to financial resilience.
When you think about managing debt, what would you say about the behaviors that enable people to do that? Because, you know, you and I have been in this space for a long time. We know that it's not just as simple as, oh, don't order DoorDash tonight. Don't head to the mall. It just simply isn't that simple in life.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, one of the truths of life, I mean, debt is a truth of life, right? If you will. And people take on debt in many ways. I mean, there's credit card debt, there's car loans, there's student loans, there's lines of credit, payday loans, mortgages. And I think one of the things that happens is that sometimes consumers are unaware of the long-term costs of, or certainly the total long-term costs of all of these different kinds of debts put together. And if you think about them in terms of compound interest and fees, and it's all quite dense and difficult to understand.
Now. Super helpful. I'm afraid we are out of time in our talk. We will talk again, and thank you for all the work that you are doing on improving financial resilience in this country.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me here, Bruce, and I look forward to continuing this conversation as well.
Supriya Sial is the Deputy Commissioner at the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. Coming up next on Moolala, the challengers newcomers face when trying to access financial systems in Canada. Jason Mullins is our guest. He's the president and CEO of Go Easy. And later, what to do when you want to leave part of your estate to your child who is just not going to be able to manage those assets on their own in adulthood. Rachel Blumenfeld, partner at Aird & Burliss, is going to talk about how to set up a trust. Interesting process, critical to do that thinking now. If you like what you heard today, then go back and listen to other episodes. We've been doing this show for years now, and our archives are vast. If you go to moolala.ca, you can search by topic, by guest, and you can listen to all sorts of interviews on the website or on the podcast platform, Spotify, Amazon Prime, wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can download an episode, leave a review, or subscribe to have future episodes arrive right on your device.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. I happen to believe that Financial Literacy Month is really, really important for all Canadians, young, old, any lived experience, any income level, any asset level. I'm a real fan of improving financial literacy, no matter who you are. There is a demographic, though, that faces additional challenges, and that is newcomers to Canada, right? Like, they've got so many different things that they are trying to learn and accommodate and account for, and navigating the financial system in this country is not difficult, especially challenging if English isn't necessarily your first language. So in Financial Literacy Month this year, we're going to focus on newcomers and think about how we can help those newer to Canada navigate the challenges that are ahead of us. One of the resources we're pulling in on that front is Jason Mullins. He is president and CEO of GoEasy. Hello there.
Hey, how are you?
I am well. I know we have a shared belief that newcomers to Canada are a very, very important demographic to this country. Why do you believe so strongly that we need to focus on newcomers?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that as a country, Canada's population growth driven by newcomers is a meaningful contributor to our economic success. Generally speaking, on the world stage, we're still a fairly small country by population with a very big land mass. And we have a lot to offer as a country in welcoming new people here for the chance for safety and prosperity. And therefore, they are a very big part of the Canadian history, the Canadian story, and the economic growth of our country in the future.
You have a number of perspectives here. So, of course, you have many, probably hundreds, if not thousands of employees who are relatively new to Canada. It is also a part of the makeup of the clients that you serve. What are some challenges that you see as it relates to newcomers and how they navigate the financial system here in Canada?
Yeah, so as you pointed out, we at GoEasy offer consumer loans to Canadian borrowers. Many times newcomers have been challenged with building a credit history and building a credit profile, and therefore turn to organizations like ours as alternative sources of credit because they need to establish building a credit profile, learning about how credit scores work, and generally speaking, although Canada as a country has been progressive and welcoming with increasing the level of immigration here to our country, the financial system is lagging and hasn't structurally caught up. And so much of the core traditional financial system, the major banks, have not really built products and services yet that perfectly cater to that individual. And so generally the biggest issue they face is they come in. They often have had great credit history in the country that they immigrated from. They often have some financial means. In fact, that's often a requirement to immigrate to Canada, but they just lack an understanding of how the Canadian specific financial marketplace works, and they lack the credit history that's needed for them to be able to access credit from traditional banks.
So how do you address that? I mean, at the one end of the spectrum, there is a hard no, like institutions are like, I can't lend you anything. And on the other hand, there is an easy yes, but at a prohibitive cost. How do you find the balance of risk versus rewards? You're a publicly traded company, you're a business.
Yeah, so it's difficult. I mean, this is something all financial institutions are grappling with and struggle with. The things we're doing are, number one, trying to find ways to use other data sources that we can rely upon to better assess a newcomer's true creditworthiness. Two examples. One, about 2 years ago, we started using consumer banking data to be able to underwrite a borrower as opposed to just the traditional credit report and traditional credit score. So if a newcomer has been here for several months, opened a bank account and started spending and using that account, we can take that bank information and look at the banking history, the propensity with they receive income and pay bills, and we can use that as another way to be able to underwrite and offer them credit as an alternative to the traditional credit score. Another example, we're working with a firm at the moment to get ready to run a pilot on actually taking in and using credit reporting information from other countries that they may have originally immigrated from, where we can actually look at the bureau data from where they came from and hopefully use that to make a good decision and extend credit. So one way is just trying to use different sources of data that break through the traditional method of evaluating people for credit and then find a way to extend credit that way. The other way we're trying to approach it is just through the act of financial literacy, helping them just generically understand how our financial system works. We have Go Easy Academy that we built and is available online, which is this great free set of resources for how to understand basic information about budgeting and credit scores and access to credit. We are getting ready to offer a course and a program that'll be available through Easy Academy that people can enroll in and take for free. It'll be available in any languages. So that will hopefully educate them on how our financial system works. They'll then hopefully pursue going and getting access to the products that allow them to create a credit file and build a credit file so that we can then offer them a wider range of credit products in the future.
At the front line of your service offering are a lot of people who are having human-to-human conversations with newcomers. How do you ready them for that? Because it would seem that there's an importance that they have that they're really grounded, not just in the products and services that you're selling, but in some of the foundational knowledge that's requisite in order to use those products and services responsibly.
Yeah, so three things there. Number one, we hire and recruit new Canadians and make sure that they represent a portion of our employee base as they are a meaningful part of the customer segment that we serve. So it is at any given time very common that 5 or 10% of our entire employee base will have been recently landed new Canadians. You know, they still don't have full citizenship, and we're hiring them under permanent residency or a work permit and putting them in our branches and teaching them and training them. But it gives a familiar face and you know, a personal experience with which they can talk to and communicate with other new Canadians. The second thing we're doing is we're training them. Like when we onboard our employees, we try to impart upon them the improved level of financial literacy that we're hoping to impart on our customers. So we offer a number of courses that are available internally that we put those employees through so that they get a better sense of how basic credit, basic banking, basic budgeting works, and just better prepares them to be able to communicate with our customers and with newcomers that come in and visit us. And the third thing we do is, you know, we're a very, very multicultural organization. Our employees represent 72 different countries and nationalities, and that allows us to actually staff our branches in all of the communities across Canada with the people that look like the people that live in those communities. So we have a very multicultural employee base that allows customers across Canada from all different backgrounds to know when they come into an Easy Financial branch in their community, they're going to be talking to someone that often has a similar cultural or ethnic background that they can relate to, or maybe even speaks the language that they speak and can help bridge the communication gap.
What have you noticed about building trust for newcomers that might be different from building trust with someone who's been here for five generations because they've driven by one of your branches in their neighborhood for a decade, someone who's relatively new, who's trying to figure out which of the institutions, who can I trust? How does taxation work? Like all those things that they're trying to learn, again, in a language they may not speak very well, I can imagine that building that trust is, if not exponentially, then certainly somewhat more difficult to do than with someone who's heard of you before and it's no big deal.
Yeah, I think a big part of that is just sitting down and being willing to have an open and honest conversation. It's the best way to build trust. And unfortunately, what happens is a lot of times they go into their local bank branch and assume that that might be the first point of connection for them to our financial system. And the bank system isn't necessarily built to immediately cater to someone just walking in off the street with no bank account or no credit history. The teller experience, if you will, isn't really conducive to having a fulsome conversation. So hopefully they are able to get in touch with the right person at a bank that can get them an appointment or a meeting to sit down and do that education, but that's not always the case. So for us, we make sure that every time someone walks into one of our branches, the purpose and the objective is to get them to sit down, feel warm, feel welcome, and have a conversation. Talk a little bit about what are their financial circumstances. Do they understand how credit works? Explain a little bit about the basic elements of credit. Talk to them about the products and services we offer. You know, give them the choice to decide if they want to continue to consider doing business with us or not. But at the very least, take the time to have a basic level of communication and relationship building. And I think that just brings down people's guard and gets them to be willing and open and put their trust in us.
I know one of the values of your organization is to ensure that your people are out there in the world. You're shaking hands and kissing babies and meeting people and ensuring that you have connections, regardless of where you are in the hierarchy, with the public, the clients that you serve. If you were to meet a relative newcomer to Canada and have 5 minutes in which to have a one-on-one conversation, and you had an opportunity to give them one piece of advice on navigating their credit in this future that will unfold for them in the next couple of decades, what would that one piece of advice to a newcomer be?
Yeah, so it would for sure be to find and open one new credit trade as quickly as possible. Even if that means it's a secured trade where you've got to provide collateral, even if that means it's a higher cost trade that you may have to pay a little more, even if that means having to get a co-signer, like a friend or family member, to sort of backstop you, there's going to be some trade-offs on that first line of credit that you open, because the institution is taking, you know, often an unknown risk, and therefore there's a trade-off, whether it's the cost, whether it's the co-applicant, whether it's the security, there's something that often has to be given in exchange. But by opening that initial credit trade, you start to build the all-important credit history. If you look at the construct of a credit score, two-thirds of the algorithm is based upon consistent payment history. There has to be the prevalence of a line item on the credit file that shows on-time payment history in some shape, some format, and that is going to build and accelerate your credit score. And as that happens, it just opens up a much bigger world of possibility for the financial institutions you now have access to and are able to do business with. So that would be number one. Don't overthink, well, I'm going to need an applicant or I have to put some cash as collateral. It might be a little more expensive. That is just the means to the end. The end is the objective, which is get a trade under your belt and build the credit.
Yeah, I feel like there's a saying, something like, how do you begin on the journey is take that first step. And what you're describing really Absolutely. Is the first and probably most critical step. Jason, thank you for your time today.
Very welcome. Appreciate it. Thanks for having
me. Jason Mullins is president and CEO of GoEasy. He was here to talk about Financial Literacy Month and specifically the focus on newcomers to Canada. Credit Canada has made a huge effort to support newcomers to Canada this Financial Literacy Month. It has developed an e-learning platform that's called Building Credit from the Ground Up, a program for newcomers to Canada. And get this e-learning is available in 8 languages: English, French, Arabic, Farsi, Hindi, Spanish, simplified Chinese, and Tagalog. You can access this from any device, from your phone, from an iPad, from your computer, and each module is going to take you under 15 minutes to complete. There's quizzes and case studies and other interactive elements. It's kind of like a fun thing to do. There's a bunch of topics, beginning with the essentials of credit in Canada. Like, what is credit? Why is it so important in Canada? Not just to allow you to borrow money, but it may be the key thing you need to help you rent an apartment when you get here. Other modules focus on how to build your credit history, how to improve your credit score, and what to do if you run into problems with credit. All of this is free, and you can access it by going to creditcanada.com/newcomers. That's creditcanada.com/newcomers, a free e-learning program for newcomers to Canada.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later on Moolala, Rachel Blumenfeld, partner at Aird & Burliss, talks us through the options if you want to leave part of your estate to an adult child who can't manage it on their own. She'll talk about how to set up trusts. But first, some common mistakes people make when it comes to sustainable investing. Tim Nash, sustainable economist, founder of Good Investing. We'll talk about what those mistakes are and how to avoid them.
Yeah.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Sustainable investing. Great. Easy to do. Great. Oh, maybe not so easy to do. My next guest, Tim Nash, we've had him on the show before. He's the founder of Good Investing, and he was listening to one of his favorite podcasts, Freakonomics, and it was an episode called Are ESG Investors Actually Helping the Environment? What a great title. And he actually thinks there's some mistakes. There were some mistakes in that podcast. So we're going to have a conversation about that, not just to, you know, point our fingers at other podcasts, but to illuminate some of the, I think, misconceptions around sustainable investing. Hello there, Tim.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks so much for having me on.
So was this like a trust when one of your podcasts, your favorite podcast, you're listening to it and you're like, no.
I mean, I can only imagine. I was walking my dog and people must have seen me sort of shaking my fist at the sky.
Uh-huh.
You know, I hear this title, I read the description of the podcast episode. I was all set and ready to go. And as I listened to it, you know, my heart just sank and it just kept sinking. You know, they just got so much so wrong. And it was just so frustrating for me. And yeah, I mean, it definitely, sadly, like makes me question a bunch of the other episodes that I love and, you know, really believe and follow. And I'm like, have they made these other kind of mistakes?
You have outlined the list, and it's not a super short list, beginning with the mushiness that, and I know I've done, because you've talked about this, I know a lot of journalists who lump all of it together. So ESG, environment, social, governance, sustainable investing, it's all one big Club Med buffet. And in your world, that is inaccurate. It is not one big Club Med buffet where it's all just one thing. They're distinct. Tell us why.
Well, and I mean, you can pick and choose. Like, I want to be clear, this is sort of an a la carte menu that, you know, everyone can go through and decide the change theory and the approaches that are best for them. But really, it just drives me nuts when people do take some liberties with the language. The approach that I take is to kind of have this banner headline of sustainable investing. Now, when I started in this industry 15 years ago, we called it socially responsible investing. Now, I would call that banner sustainable investing. And then under that, we have two sort of main categories of doing less evil versus doing more good. And these are totally separate, distinct approaches. We're on the doing less evil side. The goal is to earn market rates of return. So the same financial returns you would otherwise, but, you know, do a little less evil. And there are a few different ways that you can go about doing that.
And this would this be one that we would hear the most about in terms of, you know, sovereign funds or pension funds saying, we're going to divest. We're not going to support fossil fuels. That's just doing less evil.
That's right. It really, this is, I think, the most common, especially with people who are trying to maximize risk-adjusted returns. You know, and certainly what's really taken over the dialogue over the last few years is this acronym ESG, Environmental Social Governance, which falls under that doing less evil category. This is a really obvious, no-brainer investment approach in my mind, that instead of just looking at financials, for a company's operations, you know, we're expanding that analysis and also looking at environmental, social, and governance issues, which in my mind are clearly linked to a company's bottom line. And I think it's been kind of silly that we've ignored them for so long. So now investors are really catching on that ESG gives us a fuller picture of a company's operations. And so there's no surprise that that's kind of shot to the top as the most popular sustainable investment approach. Mm.
Do more good, it seems like a bigger idea or maybe a higher standard. How would you describe the activities under that umbrella?
Yeah, so I really kind of look at doing more good as now all of a sudden, you know, we're looking to have this positive impact, maybe even as the primary measure that, you know, obviously these things are going to be less diversified. So we might look at things like investing in renewable energy or clean technology or water infrastructure. These are what we call themes. So in the same way that people might carve out part of their portfolio for, you know, different themes, innovation, technology, biomedical, you know, crypto for a while was an investor theme. You know, oftentimes people carve out part of their portfolio for these green themes, but also there's the piece that I'm really passionate about that we talked about last time, which is community bonds. This is the real like crunchy granola, grassroots, doing more good stuff. But there, we're not trying to maximize risk-adjusted returns. We are really trying to, first and foremost, have a positive impact in the world, knowing that we're probably taking more risk and maybe getting a lower return than we would otherwise. Whereas with all of these doing less evil approaches that are more popular, that are more common, especially with the bigger investors, you know, you don't need to sacrifice returns there at all. You're getting very much the same risk-adjusted returns. You're just trying to do less evil while you're doing it.
Mistake number two that Freakonomics made, in your view, was to pick a dominant sustainable investment strategy. So they really focused on one. You don't think that's the right approach?
No. And I mean, this drove me nuts. And I get it from a research perspective, right? Like if you're a researcher, you know, you're doing a paper, you've got to pick one thing. You can't be looking at the whole buffet. You know, you need to pick one dish and kind of focus in on that dish. I get it. But it really does a disservice to the broader sustainable investment market. Because climate change, don't get me wrong, you know, very, very important issue. A lot of surveys do put it at the top of the list in terms of financial materiality. So understanding that, you know, we're seeing climate risk happening. And if we do start to transition, that's going to create a lot of economic risks and opportunities. That said, it's really the clients that I meet, the people I meet with, some of them care about climate first and foremost. Not all of them. Certainly no one cares only about climate. You know, we are facing a number of crises in the world right now. I don't need to tell you, you know, obviously on the micro level, the affordability crisis and, you know, the housing crisis and those things. On the macro scale, oh my goodness, the things that are happening in the world right
now.
The
list is long.
Well, yeah, like we don't need to get into that. But needless to say, these things are all connected. And people have a totally independent set of values and priorities. So to kind of, you know, pigeonhole sustainable investors to say you only care about this one issue and you're only going to use this one approach, you know, just felt really cheap to me. You know, really people care about so much more than just climate change right now. And you know, to me, it meant that they were really only focusing on a fraction of the overall sustainable investment industry and then kind of making assumptions about the whole thing.
Another mistake, and I smile because the way you write it is so, I don't know, inflammatory, delightful. So the mistake is assuming that fossil fuel companies give a damn about the green transition. I interview these CEOs. I see their plans. I am a deluded optimist. You are, I don't know, probably more of a realist in this regard. How come?
Maybe a bit of a cynic, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, really what I've seen is that, so there are these different, you know, sustainable investment approaches, doing less evil, shareholder engagement, you know, using our shares to push companies in the right direction. The argument that the paper made is that, you know, that for investors who care about climate change, they're better off investing in companies that produce a lot of CO2 emissions, because if they can use that money to reduce their CO2 emissions, then it'll have a much bigger impact. The idea is that, hey, if I can get, you know, a large oil and gas company to reduce their emissions by 10%, because they emit so much, that 10% is going to be way more emissions than getting, you know, I don't know, a heat pump manufacturer to reduce their emissions by 30%, you know, you'd have a bigger impact by going after the large emitters. And the problem is that the assumption the researchers make is that companies are going to use that cash, that if we invest in oil companies, that they're going to use that money to invest in greener solutions. And that just hasn't been the case at all. I can point to you, you know, company after company after company, these fossil fuel companies right now are not investing in green technologies. Instead, they are issuing dividends and they are buying back shares at record rates. So they're giving this money to investors. And any cash that's left over, they're actually acquiring more fossil fuels. But they've kind of realized, hey, like, let's keep this party going as long as we can. And they're actually acquiring smaller companies. Most of the big players, you know, we've seen lots of examples of this, even just over the last month or so. So, you know, to me, to assume that, hey, you know, let's give more money to the fossil fuel companies so that they can green their operations, that's not happening at all. You know, the biggest talk, at least in Canada, is around carbon capture and sequestration, right? And this is kind of the big approach to sort of, you know, green the oil sands. And really, in my mind, like, they want the government to pay for 2/3 of that. Like they're going hat in hand to the government. They're expecting taxpayers to foot the bill for that. They're not going to do it themselves. So to me, it's just like, you know, if you look at the facts, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks at a certain point. Really, in my mind, when it comes to these oil companies, some of the most responsible or sustainable in Canada, you know, they're the CEO of Suncor, which for a long time was sort of the most progressive on these issues, has really stepped back the language. You know, we're seeing them kick the can down the road a lot further, really pulling back on any of their climate initiatives. So, you know, I think it's just foolish at a certain time, you know, fool me once, shame on me, but, you know, fool me,
fool you twice. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. I think
that's it. That, you know, we can,
how that goes.
Push these companies towards sustainability, you know, for long enough, but at a certain point, they kind of tell us who they are. And over the last few years, I'd say that they have.
I want to ask one last question. You live at the very high end of understanding about the nuance here of coaching your clients to behave in a way that is consistent with their values. Everyone, in fact, most people aren't anywhere near the level of engagement that you have. It's your life's work here. So for people who are like, ugh, fine, I'll do one silly little stupid thing because Tim wants me to, if they're willing to do one thing in order to make the planet a better place, what is your oversimplified answer to that question?
It really just starts by asking what's inside my portfolio. It's the simplest question that most Canadians just simply haven't asked. And get a feel for that. I mean, you've got experts on here time and time again to talk about, you know, how knowledge is power and, you know, understanding how your fees work. You know, we certainly there are a lot of opportunities for us to make smarter decisions when it comes to our investments. And to me, it really just starts with this question, what's inside? And most banks and groups all have options now. So for most people, it can just be as simple as ticking a box.
Right.
Moving over to that better option. Right. So it doesn't need to be as, you know, big and hairy as I sometimes make it out to be. You know, but really it just comes down to that simple question. What's inside my portfolio?
Doesn't have to be a gut renovation. It could be a few new throw pillows in the living room. All right. And that would make a difference. Tim, thank you for your time today.
Bruce, it's always a pleasure.
You're welcome. Tim Nash, founder of Good Investing. And we were talking about his reaction. He was somewhat more measured than maybe he could have been. His reaction to coverage in a podcast called Freakonomics about ESG in particular and some mistakes that he believes they made in that episode. Coming up, we'll talk about how to set up a trust as a part of your estate plan if you want to leave part of your estate to an adult child who may not be able to manage that on their own. Maybe they've got mental health issues. Maybe they have a disability. Rachel Blumenfeld is a partner at Aird and Burliss, and she has some tips. And if you want the latest and greatest that Moolala has to offer, you can sign up for our newsletter. Super simple to do. You go to moolala.ca, sign up for the newsletter, and once a month, we will send you a list or a newsletter of all the things we have done on this show on SiriusXM, on CBC Radio, on CityLine, all the things. We'll send you all the things.
We all believe in the possibilities of tomorrow. And at Easy Financial, we're here to help you every step of the way. If the banks aren't an option, we can help get you approved for a loan in as little as 10 minutes. And with our personal, home equity, and auto loans, you can choose the loan that's right for you, so you can start rebuilding your credit for a better tomorrow. Apply today without affecting your credit score at easyfinancial.com or at over 400 locations and find out how much you can qualify for. Easy Financial. Better tomorrows.
We talk a lot about the estate planning process around here, A, because it is so important, and B, because there's a lot of different circumstances that can inform the things that you need to think about early in life. How you address circumstances relative to your specific environment, your specific family, are really critical to think about. So we received a question from a listener asking what they can do if they want to leave part of their estate to a child who won't be able to manage it on their own. And how do they then move forward and set up something like a trust? To answer this question, we are turning to Rachel Blumenfeld, partner at Aird and Burliss. She focuses on tax and succession planning, estates, and she joins us now. Hello there.
Hello there. Thank you for having me today.
It is our pleasure. I mean, for any parent, thinking about the legacy that they leave to their child is a big and weighty decision. For a parent of a child who is not going to be able to function on their own, as someone who is neurotypical or walks a more common path, the dynamics are different and the stress probably higher. Where would you start this conversation? If you had a client in your office who came in and said, listen, these are the circumstances, what are the things that I need to be thinking about?
Right. So I think the place that I would start with is really to try to get an understanding of what the issues of the child are. Is it something where they've got addiction issues, or they've got developmental issues, mental health? Or is it just something they're young and inexperienced and, you know, maybe 15 years from now, they'll be okay. So we really want to try to understand what some of those issues are, because that will guide how we set something up. And generally what I would do is set up a trust in the parent's will that would just come into effect only on the death of the parent or on both parents, because you don't necessarily need something while everybody's around. It would really be through on death, generally. Some, you know, depends on the situation. Yeah.
What does that mean to set up a trust?
So what we would, a trust is basically an entity that would hold assets for the benefit of whoever is listed as beneficiaries. It's set up when it's being done under a will. It only gets set up once the person who dies, and then they appoint a trustee through their will to take care of that, to manage it. And that trustee will have obligations and duties to the beneficiary to carry out the wishes of the parents or the, you know, whoever it is who's left the trust, and to really protect the beneficiaries, to ensure that they're getting what they're supposed to get, that the assets are being invested well.
And how does the role of the trustee of the trust differ from the role of an executor of an estate? I mean, it sounds like there's some similarities, but also some big differences.
Good question. So often it's the same person under the will. The executor is the person who steps in right away and deals with an estate. And generally, you know, the first year or two deals with gathering up all of the assets and making sure debts are paid and income tax returns are filed. And then once all of that's done and they're ready to distribute the estate, if part of that distribution is to a trust, that executor can become the trustee of that trust. Sometimes we will use different people or entities as the trustee of that specific trust, but very often it's the same people, person or people.
That trustee would manage the cash flow for this adult child. Are they also managing the assets themselves? And if that's the case, how does the grown-up ensure that those assets will be cared for? Because I can imagine without some instruction and the trustee would need to make some choices about how risky investments were, for example.
Yeah, good question. So very, very often the trustee themselves has the obligation to ensure that the assets are being invested properly for both income to be able to pay out to the beneficiary, as well as for growth for that beneficiary and for whoever is going to end up inheriting at the end of the day. If the person who's chosen as trustee isn't a financial advisor, doesn't have that expertise, they really are required to go out and get that expertise to make sure they've hired proper financial advisors, and that they manage them, that they're reviewing what's being done on a regular basis, because they ultimately have the liability. If gets screwed up, if something happens to the funds, then it's on the trustee. So, you know, if a family doesn't really have people who are close family who have that expertise, sometimes they'll appoint a professional, whether it's a trust company, an accountant, a lawyer, to take on that role, either on their own or with a family member.
What should people know about the cost? Because as you describe it, it sounds like there's some legal work to set it up like a traditional estate plan, but then there's going to be a cost that is incurred over the course of time because the trustee's work may be a little bit this year, a lot in years to come that has to be accounted for.
Yeah. So generally, the compensation for trustees, and especially where they're professional trustees as opposed to a family member, but a family member is entitled to get paid for the work that they're doing because it can be significant. Very often it's tied to the value of the assets and the transactions, what we call the ins and the outs, what comes into the estate or into the trust and what's paid out. And it's based on a percentage of that, of those amounts. Depending on the province, that amount can be legislated, but in Ontario, it's not legislated. It's based on the decades and decades of cases that have come up with what does that compensation look like.
Would the percentage be 3%, 5%? What would be the number we should?
So usually people think of compensation for executors, and this is for the initially as being 5% of the value. And it's usually never going to be higher than that, but it could be lower. But where you've got an ongoing trust where there's transactions, often it'll be 2.5% of what comes in and 2.5% of what is paid out. But there's checks and balances on that. So, and you can determine in the will what you want that compensation to be and have an agreement with whoever is going to be doing that. So it can be a flat fee. It can be based on hourly rates, that kind of thing too.
What guidance would you have for people in terms of asset size in which this makes sense? Because what I'm hearing is, hey, it would make total sense for anybody who's got an adult child who's going to, need care and support in adulthood when the parent is no longer living. But if the estate is like $100,000, you're probably not going to have the ability to go through this exercise and have the hope that that will be maintained over the course of time. Very different if you've got $10 million.
Right. Yeah. I guess one of the things that has to be taken into account in terms of the value of the estate, first of all, as soon as there's the real estate or an insurance policy, RSPs, those kinds of things, it's going to be more than about $100,000. But one of the aspects of the planning that needs to be carefully considered is if the child is on provincial benefits, which in Ontario is the Ontario Disability Support Plan, even if it's $200,000, $300,000 that's going to go to that child, it really should be in a trust because otherwise it'll affect their other benefits. That may not matter if there's a $10 million estate, then, they can live on that. But where it's a smaller amount, you don't want to necessarily, you want to be very careful about protecting those benefits for the child.
This is not your first time talking about this. This is not your first time going through this process. And yet for the listeners for whom this is most relevant to, it's probably their first time. What is one or two pieces of advice that you would offer them as they walk this path?
I think one of the first thing and the thing that I spend a lot of time speaking with clients about is who that trustee is going to be and whether it can be a sibling or, other close relative that may work beautifully or that can create huge conflict within a family and whether that's something, when we talk through what's that going to look like in 20 years when you're daughter is in her 50s and your son is in his, you know, late 50s, how will that work out? I think that is very often the most difficult aspect of this for families, as well as, you know, in certain cases, if the issue of the child that they're concerned about isn't necessarily something where they're, you know, there's a disability or, you know, real special needs, but it's more they're concerned that the child can't manage their assets, how will that play out in terms of the family? And should the other siblings also have trust, just so that everybody's being treated the same?
Right.
Because I've seen situations where, you know, one child is sort of dealt with differently, and that can also create a lot of issues for the siblings going forward.
Yeah. And it is in the vested interest of every family to do the preparation, to have the tough conversations now before they're ending up in an office like yours with some conflict. Rachel, I really appreciate your insight. That is a knowing smile, as I'm sure you have seen it all. So let's just have everybody do the right thing in advance. Rachel Blumenfeld, partner at Aird & Burliss, here to talk about setting up a family trust if yours is a family that includes someone who may need some support in navigating their financial life after the death of their parents. That's it for our show today. A big shout out to our sponsors for supporting our efforts this year on Financial Literacy Month. Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. And Easy Financial, personal, home equity, and auto loans with personalized rates and terms made for you. We're also grateful for the support of Indeed Canada, the number one job site worldwide and the number one source of hire in Canada. And the Canadian Bankers Association, the voice of more than 60 domestic and foreign banks that help drive Canada's economic growth and prosperity. We also really appreciate the support of Achieve, a leading charitable organization that delivers employment, newcomer, language, youth, women, and inclusion services in the Greater Toronto area. If you want to send us a note, it could be thoughts on the show, feedback, questions, story ideas. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. To sign up for the Moolala newsletter, you can do so at moolala.ca. On social media, I am @BruceSellery on X, Bruce Sellery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.